I think it is sufficiently past time to begin that it is now time to begin. Last Lord's Day morning, we looked at the opening verses of Job chapter 19, which is Job's response to Bildad's speech in chapter 18. We spoke of the misinterpretation of Job's experience by his three friends. And the results of that misinterpretation and how, though Satan disappeared at the beginning of the book, after just a couple of chapters, he's still very present and very active, but he's simply working through those who were near and dear to Job, much like he does sometimes with you and with me. We're going to conclude chapter 19 this morning, and as we suggested last Lord's Day, when we get to the end of the verses, end of the chapter, we'll be looking at probably the climax of Job's faith in this book as he states, "I know that my Redeemer lives." We'll talk about those verses. One thing I did want to point out last Lord's Day morning, but I would like to say did not get to, the truth of the matter is I just forgot it. And that is, as Job begins chapter 19 here, in his response, he starts with the words, "How long?" Now, we speak a great deal about the patience of Job, but Job's patience here in chapter 19 is wearing rather thin, and he has about had it up to here, somewhere up to his eyeballs, and maybe even above his head, with the statements that his friends are making, the accusations that his friends are making, and he is ready for it to stop. It doesn't stop for a little while, but it does indeed stop after a while. In verse 4 of Job 19, Job starts, "Even if I have truly erred, my error lodges with me." Is Job admitting here in the fourth verse now that he is a sinner? No, he says, "Even if I have truly erred," even if what you say is true. He apologizes, if it be considered an apology, about like you and I do most of the time. Well, if I said anything that hurt you, and we got somebody standing in front of us crying tears. And it's fairly obvious that we have said something that hurt somebody. But at any rate, Job says, "If I have truly erred, my error lodges with me." Now, what in the world does that mean? What is your lodge? That's your dwelling place, isn't it? It says, "My error lodges with..." If I have truly erred, my error lodges with me. My error, if I have sinned as you accuse me, it hadn't caused you any harm. It hadn't invaded your tent, so to speak. So, you shouldn't be too concerned about it. If indeed you vaunt yourselves against me and prove my disgrace to me, know then that God has wronged me and has closed his net around me. Now again, let me remind you, as I have all the way through the book of Job, that this is expressed from Job's perspective. And there is no doubt in Job's mind about what is going on. And what Job perceives as going on is that God has, in essence, done him in. Know then that God has wronged me and has closed his net around me. Now, you remember back in Bildad's speech, in chapter 18, Bildad went through a whole series of hunting metaphors, and described how Job was entrapping himself, ensnaring himself. And you can go back and read, I think there were six of them. And Job here said, "No, sir, that's not really what's happened. God has wronged me, and God has closed his net around me. It isn't my sin." He's still protesting his innocence. But God has done me in. He has closed His net around me. In essence, it is God who has caused Job to suffer. And it is God who has destroyed Job's reputation for innocence. Keep in mind that before this started, Job was considered to be a good man. And all of a sudden, Job is in the midst of suffering. And from the perspective of the friends who conclude that if Job is suffering, he must have done something really bad to justify this kind of suffering. And therefore, he's no longer innocent. His reputation for innocence has been destroyed. He has, in some moral or legal sense, or both, been branded a sinner by his friends, and they, I'm sure, are representative of everyone else. Now look at verse 6. Know then that God has wronged me and closed His net around me. If Job chapter 19 were a newspaper, verse 6 would be the headline. It is the headline for what Job is fixing to put in his article. And in this article, Job is going to make some extensive charges against God. In verses 7 to 12, which is basically the next paragraph, Job is going to accuse God of having done him grievous bodily harm. And then beginning in verse 13 and coming down through about verse 19, Job is going to accuse God of alienating all of those who are near and dear to him. Let's look at verses 7 to 12. Behold, I cry violence, but I get no answer. I shout for help, but there is no justice. Have you ever been in a situation where you cried for help and there was no one to hear? I can't think of any specific movies or television shows, but I can remember the principle, and I'm sure you can too. If somebody who gets lost or is over the side of a cliff somewhere and they start shouting, help, help, because they can't go up, can't go down, all they can do is hope that somebody will hear and drop a line over the side and save them. And they shout, and they shout, and they shout, and there's no response except the echo of their voice. And that's what Job is saying here. I'm crying for help. I'm crying for justice. I'm crying for some correction. I'm crying for vindication. I'm crying to find that relationship that I had with God that I feel I have lost, that God has turned His back upon me. And all he's hearing now is an echo. I get no answer. What has he done? He has walled up my way so that I cannot pass, and he has put darkness on my paths. You ever felt like you've been walled in? Can't go left, can't go right. Can't go forward, can't go backward, can't go up, can't go down, can't go. Most of us have. And generally, when we get in that situation, instead of stopping to look, listen, and consider as to why we are there and what we can consider as being the reason for our predicament, what do? We just reach down and we get our bootstraps and we start trying to pick ourselves up and throw ourselves out of that situation. Did you ever stop to think that maybe it is God who has walled us in for some reason? That God is trying to slow us down, that God is trying to give us time to think? And shouldn't we use the adversities of life for that reason? Seems to me that makes good sense. He has walled me in. Job had enough sense to recognize that maybe God was trying to tell him something. Don't read too much into that. Providence, of course. He put darkness on my path. Can we learn from darkness other than just being scared out of our wits? I think I've told the story about when I was just a kid. Living in Austin, Texas, I used to like to go down and watch the Austin Senators play baseball. I don't remember what class they were, but they were pretty good class to me. And toward the end of our sojourn in Austin, we lived in a house that by the time the ball game was over was about a mile past the end of the bus stop. And I'd get on that old city bus, and I'd head home. And I'd get off the bus at the last stop, and I'd have that mile to walk. And on this side over here, there was a big old open field. And I just knew in the darkness that old open field was peopled with all kind of folks who had no other ambition in life than to get a young boy and to do him ill. And on the other side over here was an institution for folks who, among other things, were criminally insane. And here I was, just a kid, going down between those things. I learned the meaning of whistling in the dark. Because I'd go down the middle of that street like, well, I'm not concerned. I'm not scared. Don't mess with me. And then I'd hear a noise. I guess probably a rabbit jump off there in those weeds. And my feet wouldn't hit the ground all the way home. The darkness is peopled with terrors. And especially for folks who have much imagination. And it just scares you that it did me. And Job's in a bad shape here. He's walled my way so that it cannot pass. He's put darkness on my paths. He has stripped my honor from me and removed the crown from my head. Now that's striking at things that we hold near and dear. My position in life, my reputation in life. And God has just reached down and He's knocked the crown off my head. He's stripped my honor from me. He breaks me down on every side and I am gone. He has uprooted my hope like a tree. He has also kindled His anger against me and considered me as His enemy. His troops come together and build up their way against me and camp around my tent. In this type of poetry, not only are we concerned with each of these descriptions that Job gives of what he believes God has done to him, but we are also to get an impact from the cumulative effect of all of these things that just go wham, wham, wham. Now, you and I think, well, maybe we could take one of those hammer blows and we'd survive it. Maybe we could take two. But about the time we start to get up, wham, there's another one. We struggle to our feet and wham, there's another one. And that's exactly what's happening to Job here. Now, I want you also to notice something else in this passage. It seems to me that in this passage, verses 7 to 12, there is also some premonition of the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. Notice what he says. God considered me as his enemy. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? His friends have forgotten him. This is down in verse 14. He's made loathsome to his brothers. Verse 17. Those I love turned against me. Verse 19. Don't we see in what is happening to Job here at least some premonition of the cross of Jesus Christ? You and I sometimes sort of wander through life and we tip our hats to the cross of Jesus Christ. And having tipped our hats to the cross of Jesus Christ, then religion in general and sometimes and unfortunately more and more in this day, as I say, having tipped our hats to the cross, we then run hither and thither to make the church and everything relevant to the real issues in life. Now, there are some real issues with which we need to deal. And Job is a perfect illustration of issues with which we need to deal, from which we dare not turn away. So that those who cry for help get something besides the echo of their voice. But you and I must never forget that at the bottom of everything, there must be the cross of Jesus Christ. And that unless we deal first and foremost with the cross of Jesus Christ, then all of these so-called issues of life are absolutely unimportant. They make no difference. There are a number of things that we ought always to remember. But perhaps at the very head of that list is the eternal truth that the way of the cross leads home. Notice, if you will, in verse 12, at the end of this passage, section 7 to 12, where Job has just described hammer blow after hammer blow after hammer blow. His troops come together and build up their way against me and camp around my tent. Do you see any humor in that? Does it seem humorous to you that somewhere out in the desert there is a tent with the beleaguered Job inside, and outside of that tent, holding it in siege, are all of the armies of God? God, do you really need all of those troops for my little tent? Sort of like if I were a fugitive from justice and they sent the FBI, the CIA, the Marines, the Navy, the Air Force, and they all gathered around my little house. Said, we got you now.
You'd really be in trouble if they sent the VATF.
If they sent the ATF folks after me, I'd really be in trouble then. I tell you, I'd be in more trouble than I was walking down between those, the darkness and the institution for the criminally insane. But wouldn't it be a little overkill? And Job is saying, here I am, and God is just bang, bang, bang. God doesn't need to deal with me this way. Let's just read on because we're going to find Job right there. Verses 13 to 22, Job expresses a sense of utter forsakenness. As we say, everyone that Job holds dear turns against him. And let me just make this point here before we start looking at this. And that is Job's concern for God, and that is Job's concern all through the book of God. I want my relationship back. As we say, he wasn't after his family back. He wasn't after his riches back. He wasn't after his house back. He wasn't after his possessions back. He wanted back his relationship with God. But Job's sensitiveness to God did not make him insensitive to the people who were around him. Sometimes we get so busy with the things of God that we become insensitive to the people round about us, sort of like the priest and the Levite who walked by on the other side and were so busy getting to church, so to speak, that they just didn't have time to be concerned about people. People are our concern because people are souls. And souls live eternally. But Job has lost all of his acquaintances. Might also suggest here as we go down and read through this that you look at all of the different acquaintances that Job mentions. And I suggest to you that as all of these different acquaintances are mentioned, that this is one indication of Job's capacity for the enjoyment of life, at least in better days. And the opposite would also be true, wouldn't it? If it exhibits the height of Job's capacity to enjoy life in better days, then would not their absence indicate the depth of his hurt when they are taken away? He has removed my brothers far from me, and my acquaintances are completely estranged from me. My relatives have failed, and my intimate friends have forgotten me. Those who live in my house and my maids consider me a stranger. I am a foreigner in their sight. I call to my servant, but he does not answer. I have to implore him with my mouth. My breath is offensive to my wife. We suggested in the introductory material we'd find that Job had bad breath. My breath is offensive to my wife. I'm not sure that's what it means. But she even turns away. And we've seen her do that. And I am loathsome to my own brothers. Even young children, young children love nearly anybody, but not old Job. Even young children despise me. I rise up and they speak against me. All my associates abhor me, and those I love have turned against me. Now, I want you to listen to verses 20 to 22. Because I think this gets Job right where Bob was talking about a while ago. And Job is really pouring out his soul in these verses. All of his dignity is gone. All of his self-composure has been lost. Blow after blow from God has come, and now he lies broken beneath the blows of God and the words of men. And he appeals to God for justice. He appeals to men for pity. But instead, both alike pursue him. My bone clings to my skin. He's emaciated in my flesh. I've escaped only by the skin of my teeth. My life, I'm just barely hanging on. Pity me. Pity me, O you, my friends. For the hand of God has struck me. Why do you persecute me as God does and are not satisfied with my flesh? Let me ask you a question. Who is the most important person in the church? Must be the elders. They have the responsibility, the oversight. It must be the deacons. They're to serve. Must be the Bible school teachers. They teach. Let me suggest to you that none of those answers is correct. Let me suggest to you that the most important person in the church is the person who is suffering. That's the one about whom you and I need to be most concerned. The church is a body, isn't it? What's the most important member of your body? Must be the head, must be the brain, must be the heart pumps the blood. Let me suggest to you, if you've got a hurting foot this morning, that's the most important member of your body. Maybe it's an arm, maybe it's a head. And that's exactly what your body's going to do when one member of that body is hurting. Your head, your hands, everything is going to do everything possible to alleviate that suffering. That suffering member becomes the most important one. And you and I, as members of the Lord's body, need to learn that. Pity me, O you, my friends, for the hand of God has struck me. You know, you and I tend to ask, why is there so much suffering in the world? And why doesn't God do something about it? Why don't you and I leave God's business to God? And why don't you and I ask the question, why is there so little love in the human heart, and why don't we do something about it? Maybe we don't ask that question because that's something we can do something about. Job, here in the end of this chapter, is about as low as he can get. We come face to face at this point really with a mystery in the book of Job that is almost as great a mystery as the mystery of suffering. And that mystery is why in the world Job, the sufferer, should be forced to engage in this long fight while he's suffering with those who are supposed to be his friends. But from the depths of despair, and we've seen this before in Job, and I suppose we all have times where we swing low and we swing high. But out of the depths of despair, Job still maintains his faith in God. Verses 23-29. Oh, that my words were written. Oh, that they were inscribed in a book. That with an iron stylus and lead they were engraved in the rock forever. And as for me, I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last he will take his stand upon the earth. Even after my skin is destroyed, yet from my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall myself behold, and whom my eyes shall see and not another. My heart faints within me. If you say, how shall we persecute him, and what pretext for a case against him can we find? Then be afraid of the sword for yourselves, for wrath brings the punishment of the sword, so that you may know where there is judgment. As Job reaches the end of this chapter, he expresses a certainty of final vindication. He stakes his honor, he stakes his future. His future justification on his desire to provide a permanent written record of just what has transpired. Job is saying, I want the world to know what has happened here. He's going to make a permanent record of his accusations against God. He wanted everybody to know what he's going through. A number of years ago, a group of us went over to Scotland. Brother and Sister Chester Grimes were alive and in the group. And I never will forget that one day we went up to Robert Burns' cottage. And Sister Grimes was in our little group. And Millie talks about going with me as traveling with Olin Mills, because I always camera and equipment, and I'm taking some pictures, and I was trying to get Sister Grimes in the picture. It was a nasty morning. It was a cold morning. It was miserable. And I asked Sister Grimes to come over getting this picture, and she came over with her little umbrella and said, yeah, I'm glad you're doing that. I want the folks at home to know what we're going through. We were having a good time in spite of the cold and the wet. But I never will forget that expression. And you and I in life, we always want everybody to know what we're going through. And that's what Job is saying here. I want to make a permanent record. Now, I don't know whether Job ever got around to engraving anything in stone. But one thing we can know is that Job's desire to have a permanent record made has been admirably achieved in the book that we have here from God. Well, what do these words mean? The meaning of the passage depends on the authenticity and integrity of the text. And I have told you as we have gone through the book of Job, though we've not spent a lot of time on it because I don't think it does anything for the overall message of the book, that there are some textual difficulties in the book of Job, and this passage has as many as any other passage in the book of Job. Well, what shall we do then? My suggestion to anyone who studies this passage is that we avoid two situations. Number one, avoid the situation of getting all caught up, so much caught up in the difficulties that we can't see the message. And number two, on the other extreme, is reading everything relative to what Christians know based upon the Scripture and the life and the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ back into the understanding of Job at the end of chapter 19. But the truth of the matter is that having said all of that, there are certain things that are very clear in this passage. And if we can grasp those things that are very clear, then I think we need not worry too much about some of the things that are perhaps not clear. And some of the translations that you were reading will read somewhat differently from what I am reading. And really, it is a matter of translation as much as anything. For instance, verse 26, "Yet from my flesh I shall see God," the New American Standard reads. Now, the Hebrew word that is translated there can mean from my flesh, that is, in my flesh, from within my flesh, or it can also mean from without my flesh. It can refer to either one. And so, it's a difference in translation, not a difference in the text that is being translated. But that, I think, is not a great problem for the Scripture itself. Well, what is central to the passage? One thing is central to the passage, and that's verse 25. Job wants to make a record. I think he wants to make a record because, as we have seen through the book of Job, he wants to die. He believes that death is imminent. How long can I go on in this ash heap with my emaciated condition that he's just described, with everybody having turned against me, with blow after blow raining down on me? I'm just about gone. Let me leave a record. Well, Job, even though you're going to die, what's going to happen? Is there any hope? I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last will stand on the earth. And I shall see God, whom I myself shall behold, and whom my eyes shall see, and not a stranger. There is a tremendous emphasis in this passage on the part of Job upon seeing God. And the references to skin and flesh and eyes suggest that Job is going to see God in his flesh. Now, the question then becomes, when is Job going to have this experience? And some suggest that Job believed he was going to have that experience in this life. But I think if you look at the context, both immediate and throughout the book, that's a stretch. Because if Job's going to have that experience in this life, it's going to have to come quickly because Job sees death as imminent. There are others who, while not finding the full sense of a bodily resurrection in the book of Job, find on Job's part in this passage a hope of a favorable meeting with God after death in his state as a genuine human being, which implies a bodily resurrection. I think there are good and sufficient reasons why the latter must be true. Number one, I think there's no need for a written record if it's going to take place in Job's lifetime. He wouldn't need to leave. Everybody knew what was going on. There would be no need for a written record. Secondly, I think, as we have suggested, the statement, "My Redeemer lives," is in contrast to man's death. and implicitly Job's own death. And then there is in the passage a very definite reference to end times, or an eschatological emphasis, if you want a fancy word. Because Job says, at the last, he'll stand upon the earth, and I will see God. Job knows that man lives and man dies. Job's hope had been pulled up like a tree. But that hope related primarily to this life and his position in this world. But Job, by faith, looked up and beyond the experiences of this life and expressed an ultimate faith in a Redeemer. And that's a beautiful Old Testament word. We'll not take the time to go into it. You might want to. But that was one who maintained the family honor. That was one who continued the family name. That was one who bought back the family property. That was one who was to guarantee that the lineage continued. And Job says, I've got a Redeemer. I'm going to die, but I know that my Redeemer lives. What a faith from the depths of depression. To have the only kind of faith that can lift us up and help us over, and by faithfulness to that Redeemer set us safely on the other side. May God bless us to that end. Next Lord's Day morning, let's look at chapter 20, the last speech of Zophar in the second round of speeches, and chapter 21, Job's response. We appreciate your presence, your attention, and your contribution to our class this morning.